And M will also take a look at other crucial issues facing you and your family in our one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest today is Scott Weinberg. I have interviewed Scott before, but under the name Jonathan Scott. Jonathan Scott is the pen name he used to write his recent, we published, bestiary called Beasts from the East, the Blessed Book of Beasts. You may recall, if you're a steady listener of Church and Culture, that I did a interview with him about a month ago on this wonderful bestiary that he's recently published. Scott, welcome to Church and Culture once again.
Thanks. Thank you very much. It's great.
And I might mention that you were a speechwriter for George W. Bush. You studied classical rhetoric and literature at Catholic University, which we're going to talk about today. You're a graduate of Christendom as well, and that you live in Kansas and have six children.
That's right. Yeah, that's our pride and joy as our
kids. So that would make you about 30 years old, is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, we, no, I'm a little older than that.
Well, you're blessed with a beautiful family. I was looking at their photos last night. But today, you know, I want to talk about something that we hit upon briefly in discussing the bestiary, and that is because you were using a very traditional rhyme scheme, and we discussed whether or not that you thought that was why you did it. And that brought us to a discussion of one of your favorite Catholic writers, Alexander Pope. And I made a mental note at the time that I wanted to come back and talk to you more about Pope. Give our listeners an idea of why is it important or why is it useful to know a little bit or a lot about Alexander Pope?
Well, I think historically he's a very critical writer. I think that he's kind of like the Virgil of our age. I know he.
Well, that's saying quite a bit.
I know it is. Virgil is so critical. He informed Dante so much in the Divine Comedy, and Pope was, you know, from the 18th century, so you know, a couple hundred years ago, 300 years ago, and he was just so skilled and insightful in his analysis of poetry and criticism, language in general, and I think he's just so excellent at putting everything in context.
As historically, he was one of these Catholic writers in England who had to tread very carefully, right?
He did, and so I think what he focused on was, you know, the natural philosophy behind poetry and the technique. And so we have a very useful poetics in Alexander Pope that I think is, you know, if we look at him, we can really start to put modernism in its proper context.
Now, we're talking about the mid-1700s when he was, or the early to mid-1700s when he was active?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
So he is, from a kind of a overview Western civilization, he was a in the Enlightenment, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was a classically trained scholar. I mean, he translated Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, deeply rooted in that Western humanistic tradition, but was also a public figure. I mean, quite a well-known public figure at the time.
Yeah, he didn't shy away from his satire of critics. He was very clear that one of the most important things you can have in culture is a good critic. And I think that's very true, even today. I think a lot of the problem we have even today in America, which is a great nation, is the analysis of current events is really so out of context And I think people need to see, you know, how do we put things in focus? What are we supposed to be looking at when we see something in the world today? And Pope gets into this in his essay on criticism and his approach to art and poetry. It's all about putting things in the right context and how do we do that.
Was Alexander Pope the most important Catholic writer, commentator of his generation?
In
England, that is.
Oh, certainly. I think he was. Not because he was a champion of the faith.
But he wasn't. He didn't claim to be a theologian.
No. But he, I mean, poetry really is a shortcut to natural theology, I think. He wasn't, a crusader for the church or anything like that. But he was so well read and well versed in natural philosophy, and he made nature really the object of poetry, and the law embedded in nature, the causality embedded in nature that God put there.
And this comes out in his essay on man, right?
Yeah, it does.
Is there any other places where he really makes a substantial comment on this?
In his essay on criticism, he says that this is the be-all and end-all of how we are to view things, is that really nature isn't perfect, man is not perfect, and there's no such thing as perfection in man, but we have to strive to see human events as that there's a divine purpose behind everything. And the goal of the poet is to put things in context. So I think that's very helpful for today.
Is the poet a journalist in that sense?
He was a journalist. Yes, it's more than just poetry. It's more than just metaphor and storytelling. You are the journalist of the age. You are speaking to the whole man. Look at the Iliad and the Aeneid by Virgil. It was so important to that culture, not just as a metaphor, but it helped people see what was going on in society. It linked society with the divine. And that's what Pope is saying, that's how nature is made. And man is no different now than he was in the 18th century or, you know, in the 2nd century. It just, we're still the same.
So he appreciated epic literature such as Homer. He translated it from Greek into English. I'm sure he appreciated Virgil's Aeneid for its providing a narrative for the founding and meaning of Rome. But did he ever really undertake a similar project for his own age?
He did. He wrote a number of poems. His most famous is it's a mock epic called The Rape of the Lock, which is hilarious.
Well, the word rape makes you think immediately it must be about something. So is it about that?
No, it's about the tremendous trifles of his society at that time. But he puts it in the light of an epic.
The Rape of the Lock? I mean, what does that refer to, the title itself?
Well, in the society, in the court, this man who is envious of, he's in love with a young lady and admires her. She has these two classical locks that flow down the back of her hair, and he wants to woo her, and she rejects him, and so he conspires to steal one of the locks in her hair.
Ah!
And so that is what the epic is about, and it reaches epic proportions in a mock kind of way.
And what is it a critique of the beginning of modernity? Is that what Pope is up to?
Well, I think he's just a writer at this time, writing about his society and the, you know, the details and the intricacies and kind of the silliness of some of the the minutia of social convention, and he's poking fun of it in a really hysterical way, and in a way that puts the ridiculous minutia of Enlightenment culture into proper context.
So he was kind of like a Friedrich Nietzsche, who said the best way to refute a bad idea is by laughing at it.
Yes, exactly. He was a satirist to the nth degree, and but the main thing is his command of the classics. And he says this quite clearly in his essay on criticism, that you need to understand the great writers who have gone before you. You need to be able to discern what a great poem is.
So he was like Matthew Arnold 100 years earlier, or
exactly.
Yeah. So he was saying that there is a historical tradition of learning, of writing, of speculation, of history that needs to inform our thinking in the present and going forward. We need to be in that tradition.
We do need to be in it. It's not arbitrary. The classics are classics for a reason, and we need to do more than just read them in a curriculum. We need to be able to begin to understand why they're good, and why what we may hear or read today might not be good. We need to be able to begin to make those judgments.
Well, dig down on that a little bit, Scott. I'm talking to Scott Weinberg, who is well-trained in issues of poetry, classical learning, humanistic tradition, and the relationship of the church to that tradition. He's also the author under a pseudonym, under a writer's name, Jonathan Scott, of recently published Bestiary, Beast from the East, the Blessed Book of Beasts, which we discussed in our last interview about a month ago, and we'll give a little more information on that later and how to order it. Drill down a little deeper on just what kind of recommendations does Alexander Pope make regarding learning how to, as it were, discern the spirits of the age and of particular works.
He has a Catholic view of man. Man is really flawed. You know, the intellect is weak. The will is weakened by the fall of man, and pride is ever present. And the human mind tends to gravitate towards error at first, and so we need to, as you say, drill down to get to the fundamental basis of things. And so his prescription is to read the classics and read the great authors and to discern why they are, what makes them great, what makes them stand the test of time. Why is Virgil regarded as great in our literary history? And he says pride is a common fault. It's the first fault of the erring mind. And
of the critic.
Isn't that so true? Yeah. I mean, of the critic. That's
well, critics are known to be proud. I mean, we take the leading movie critics or book critics. Most of the time, they have a reputation for ego.
They do. I mean, look at the. Have you been on Facebook lately? And just the, just the realm of the of proud opinion that is just thrown.
Oh, of the movie actors in particular.
Yeah, and just everybody and his dog is a critic. And
well, why does a critic have to? I mean, a critic, whether in the specific or broad sense, why do they have to have humility? What is going on there?
Well, they need to. He says that the poets, of the people who write poems in society, and he was talking about in his time, but we can be talking about our own time too, that for every one poet who's doing harm to society by his lack of skill or his failure to be able to craft a good metaphor, or he's masquerading as a poet. There are 10 critics doing 10 times as much damage as any poet could, because they fail to recognize their important role in promoting the arts and being a standard bearer for good art.
So there's a certain enlightenment optimism that a Pope, Alexander Pope, a Catholic, perhaps, as you say, the most important Catholic writer of his age, there's a certain, what we would call, enlightenment optimism that is present in his work.
Yeah, I think you could call it that. And that's a very good way to say it.
But that optimism also often gets faulted for leading to things like the French Revolution.
Well, I think for Pope, he focuses the reader, he trains the reader to look at nature, to look at human nature, and to realize that the human subject is dependent on laws that are greater than himself, and they're good. The universe is governed by nature, and nature is fundamentally good. And I think that that is a great remedy to the problems that led to the French Revolution. I think there was just massive failure in judgment that led to all of that, and horrible, people beheading Catholics and
beheading them, and beheading each other eventually. Just like Aristotle says, thieves don't have friends; they only have accomplices.
Yeah. And the Pope writes, "Trust not yourself, but to your defects know. Make
wow.
use of every friend and every foe." So he is saying that we can learn from our faults. Don't try to find perfection in anything. That's not the goal of the Enlightenment. The goal of the Enlightenment is truly to illumine things and to see the defect. Every poem has a defect. Don't fault a poem because it has a defect. Fault a poem by looking at the overall, at the whole. Where is the poem going as a whole? The Enlightenment really lost that focus.
So you don't think that Alexander Pope was guilty of the kind of optimism toward human nature that led, say, to Rousseau and subsequent events of the French Revolution? You think he was a more sober kind of optimist?
Yeah, I mean, he really was a remedy. He was a kind of a voice crying in the wilderness at that time, and kind of like T.S. Eliot, who was really a lot of people view him as embedded in modernism. But he was, if you read him, he has a very classical core in the midst of a modernistic culture.
Well, but there's nothing optimistic about T.S. Eliot's vision of human nature. I mean, he is observing and recounting the wasteland, as he calls it.
Yeah, I think he does provide remedy, though. He's calling for a... If you look at the overall, I think he's calling... he's a realist. He sees this great calamity coming, but he calls for a return to orthodoxy, a return to doctrine, a return to dogma. Pope is like that in a sense. He's far more lyrical and far more at play in his words. He's not in any way as pensive and as dark as a Rousseau, but he is... he's enlightened in a very positive way.
I'm talking with Scott Weinberg about the work of the classical writer and Catholic writer, Alexander Pope, who was perhaps the most important Catholic writer of his age in 18th century England. Give us an example of something from Alexander Pope that you admire.
Well, his essay on man is really quite something. He talks about man's place in relation to God and creation, and so you have a Catholic heart in the midst of this poem, and you have a Catholic view in the midst of Enlightenment philosophy.
And in the midst of English persecution of Catholics.
Exactly. He was a survivor. He was able to escape. He was able to go to Catholic schools in London, which were tolerated. He was able to participate in Mass. And he was able to write about natural theology in a way that's consistent with Catholic teaching.
Read us something.
Okay, this is from the essay on man. When I was going to school, this was one of the sections that the professor relied on to give us an example of what is excellent in terms of metaphor and poetic technique. God loves from whole to parts, but human soul must rise from individual to the whole. Self-love but serves the virtuous mind to wake. As the small pebble stirs the peaceful lake, the center moved, a circle straight succeeds, another still, and still another spreads. Friend, parent, neighbor first it will embrace, his country next, and next all human race. Wide, the more wide, the overflowings of the mind take every creature in of every kind. Earth smiles around with boundless bounty blessed, and heaven beholds its image in his breast. So that's a sonnet.
Well, it's interesting. Go back and reread the few lines about the image of the circle.
Okay, self-love but serves the virtuous mind to wake as the small pebble stirs the peaceful lake. The center moved, a circle straight succeeds, another still and still another spreads. Friend, parent, neighbor first it will embrace, his country next and next the human race.
Well, the reason I asked you is that I want to read back to you a few lines from William Butler Yeats.
Yeah.
Where he says the following. He says, turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold.
Yeah.
So that you can draw a direct line from the optimism, as it were, of the natural theology in Alexander Pope to the pessimism of another Catholic writer, William Butler Yeats.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. That's really excellent parallelism there between Pope and Yeats, kind of inverse parallel.
Yeah, I mean, they're one is working on the in the context of the world prior to the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and so forth, where World War One, whereas William Butler Yeats is writing on the other side of all that.
Right, yeah. Yes, he is. And we're on the other side of something, too, I think, hopefully. And it's important, as you point out, Pope was really on the front end of that and was doing something that I think needed to be done in our, poetic history. And he was showing the reader that there's a DNA in nature that is put there, and it's good, and it's related to how man wakes up and views nature and sees God as the creator of nature, and you see this in his meter, his rhyme, his metaphor. And his technique, he uses this very rare technique called chiasmus, which is a mirrored reflection of words.
Give us an example of that.
Well, in The Rape of the Lock, Bo banished Bo and coaches drive. And in this verse, the center moved, a circle straight succeeds. Another still and still another spreads. His country next and next. That sort of thing. You have the right in the middle of the couplet. You'll have the two beats with one word, and then the reflection of the word in the last part of the iambic pentameter.
Use this line and explain to our reader exactly what chiasmus means. The line is, never let a fool kiss you or a kiss fool you.
Right. See, it's a mirror image of what you have before. And so what you have is an imitation. And that's what art is. It's an imitation, right? It's like a mirrored image of nature. And so, and this is what DNA is, right? It's a when nature reproduces itself through the cause of nature, you have images and likenesses being produced. And this is how the mind learns, and according to the classical view, this is how we learn things. It's through likenesses, through metaphors.
Now, can Alexander Pope be read by, say, the average motivated reader? Can Alexander Pope be read with pleasure? And you're going to have to give me 1 minute on this because we're coming up to a break.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's the third most widely read author, poet in the English language, behind Shakespeare and Tennyson.
Is he really?
Yes, he is. And his couplets.
How do we know that?
We know these things.
Okay, well, I'll ask you that, but on the other side, but what would convince a listener to pick up, say, Rape of the Lock, Essay on Man, some sort of Alexander Pope, and read it? 1 minute.
Couplets. His couplets. Alexander Pope's wit. In the couplet, you have a two-line, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that's one line, and then you have the exact same line, and they rhyme, and you have a complete thought, a complete, almost like syllogistic thought, usually conveyed through a metaphor, so it's like a persuasive metaphor. And so there's great learning in just the most concise, precise form of language that is delightful. God loves from whole to parts, but human soul must rise from individual to the whole. Isn't that
wonderful?
True?
Yeah. And we'll be right back with more from Scott Weinberg on the subject of Alexander Pope and other things after this message.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Dunha-Garmo, co-publisher and editor-in-chief of the Chaldean News. It's a news magazine for the Chaldean community, about the Chaldean community, and for anyone who wants to engage the Chaldean community. As Christians from Iraq, Chaldeans are proud supporters of Ave Maria Catholic Radio. We invest many hours into this monthly news magazine to keep you invested in the community. You can subscribe or advertise today. Contact us at www.chaldeannews.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
The last thing Donna Long expected when she accompanied her husband to Lourdes is that he would die in that famous Marian shrine. This is Peggy Stanton. Please join me on Power from the Pews to hear Donna's inspiring story of acceptance of God's will. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio. Encoring on Sunday at 9:30 a.m.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
One of the signs of strong commitment between a husband and a wife is that they have a strong identity as a couple. Having a strong couple identity means there's a me, a you, and an us, like the Trinity. All three identities matter, and all are honored in how we go through life together. Unfortunately, new research by sociologist Dr. Paul Amato argues that couples are fast becoming married singles. Millennial couples are substantially less likely than couples in 1980 to eat together, visit friends together, go out for leisure activities together, or work on projects around the house together. They were less likely to participate in clubs or groups together as well. Home alone becomes alone together. Catholic couples can stand against this tide. Make time for your marriage when you plan your week. Remember that the most important activity is family life. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Back with Scott Weinberg. We're talking about the great Catholic writer of 18th century England, Alexander Pope, one of the few well-known Catholic writers of an age where Catholic writers in England were persecuted and had to be very careful. Scott, tell us a little bit about Pope's faith. I noticed that the Catholic Encyclopedia article, which admittedly is dated now, but makes the claim that Pope wasn't exactly an ardent Catholic. Is that true?
I think that as a poet, I don't look at that. Well, I've never heard of any evidence to suggest that he was not an ardent Catholic. I've never heard that before, and I just look at what is in his words, and what you have in his words are a Catholic view of causality embedded in nature. And he was living in England at a time when Catholics were thrown in jail for life sentences. So
he may have been, well, Shakespeare, of course, hit it really well. But he may have had a little bit of, well, I'm going to express it through my work, but no, I'm not going to name names.
Exactly. And again, he wasn't like a Catholic crusader. He wasn't like a Thomas More. He's not a saint. He's just one of the best poets that humanity has ever produced. One of my professors, who was a Pope scholar, at Catholic University, declared that Pope was a good Catholic, a hidden Catholic, afraid of persecution. But we focused on the notions of causality, which are embedded in his poetry, the natural theology, the stuff that he could write about without getting thrown in jail. And I think that this is significant. This is his contribution to humanity. And we have to realize that when Pope lived in London, Catholics were sent to the Tower and thrown in jail. All of their properties it was a persecution. So
it seems that Alexander Pope also had a gift for compression of, in language, of rather profound thoughts. For example, I did not know this till I was looking around this morning, that Pope is the one who first said, to err is human, to forgive divine. Now, everybody has heard that, but I don't think they know it came from Alexander Pope.
No, that's just not the only one. A man's reach should exceed his grasp.
That's Pope, too?
That's Pope, too, yeah. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread.
Oh, that's an Elvis Presley song. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread.
Elvis stole it from Alexander Pope.
Well, he did. Now,
it just it was.
Did he deliberately set out to write pithy sentences like that, pithy sayings?
No, he wrote, he set out to master the art of poetry, and in heroic couplets, which it was a new form at that time, but it's a concise form that conveys a complete thought, has complete logic in it. So you have two lines that match each other, kind of like a chiasmus, and you have a form that really, if you boil it all down, it's like one of the chains of DNA. Again, it's language is like that. Language is like that too. Nature is like that. There's an economy. There's a brevity. Brevity and wit go hand in hand. Brevity is the soul of wit. Is that Did you say that one already?
That's Shakespeare. Well, Shakespeare said that, right? I mean, that's Shakespeare in Hamlet, right? Or is that Pope?
That's Pope.
Ah.
And can you Google that? Just
I will. I will while we're talking.
That Google is as a good friend of the poets, and
it's
Google
Shakespeare. It's Shakespeare. I'm right. It's Shakespeare, okay. Hamlet.
Yeah, well, you're infallible. So.
I got that one. Oh no, but I got that one.
but the poetry has it needs to be concise. There's no point in.
Well, it's all about compression of meaning into language.
It is, and so you can read a couplet and really ponder it for a while, and that's why Pope is so delightful today, because you can just pick it up and kind of ponder.
It's almost explosive. I did want to hit you with this Pope quote that I think is brilliant. The worst of madmen is a saint run mad.
That makes you think, doesn't it?
And it makes me think it's a very accurate description of many of the great saints. I mean, St. Francis was considered a madman. I mean, we go on and on and on, right?
Yeah, I was talking to my dad the other day, and I said, Dad, you can tell people that your son is a poet. And, you know, he asked me if I built my fence and everything like that. And
My dad would have slugged me in the face if I had said that. I mean, it was bad enough that I was going to teach philosophy, but if I told him that I was going to write poetry and publish it, he would have flat out taken a golf club and hit me over the head.
Well, my dad is maybe a little different. He wants me to kind of walk around the yard and do kind of things that look kind of crazy, because, you know, I might acquire a reputation as a credible poet faster if I.
Well, you are a credible poet, as we established in our last interview when we went over your newly published bestiary, which I strongly recommend. Now, could we go ahead and provide our listeners with information on how that can be purchased, because it's just Christmas is coming up, and listeners, listen to me. Deal Hudson says, and I mean this, I'm being very sincere. If I had children who were saved from 7 or 8 up to 12, 13, 14, this would be an ideal Christmas gift for them. It's an ideal Christmas gift for anybody, but especially if you want to sit down and have just a great evening reading this aloud, talking about it, laughing about it, looking at the images, all these images with every beast that is presented. So, Scott, how can our listeners get your bestiary in time for putting it under the Christmas tree?
Well, they can. It's really easy. They can do it online. They can go to kellerbooks.com, K-E-L-L-E-R, books.com, and it's right there. Keller is a great provider of good books, great books, and they're selling it. You can go to Eastern Christian Publications. That's ecpubs.com. And you can get it there on their online catalog, new titles. You can get it in the bookstore of the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. It's in bookstores, but it, you know, if you want it online, that's the way to do it. And thank you. It's a good book. I mean, it doesn't.
No, it's really a good book, and I want us to read together your poetic introduction to the Blessed Books of Peace. We'll do this antiphonally.
Oh, great.
You read along, and as soon as you pause, I'll jump in, and then I'll pause. So go ahead.
Okay, I'll read the first quatrain, okay?
There you go.
Thank you very much for keeping books upon your mantelpiece and in your nooks, tucked inside your desk and on your table to browse through any time that you are able.
A bestiary is a kind of book full of diverse creatures. Have a look at reptiles, mammals, hooked, winged, and aquatic, backyard bugs and insects most exotic.
So human-like, the creatures oft will lend themselves as living lessons for the end of learning through their happiness and strife, truths about the higher things in life.
So, if a bat flies down your chimney nightly, just open up the door for it politely. And if it flies away, don't be alarmed. Its great respect for you will go unharmed.
And if you see a hippo in your pool, don't be alarmed. It loves to keep its cool. And if an ostrich strolls across your yard, be kind to it. That isn't very hard.
For God reveals and nature is displayed, and God is known through everything he's made. And though we're made uniquely in his form, we share the same creature as the worm.
So come along, dear reader, come along. Rise up in poetry, rejoice in song. All creatures from the noblest to the least reveal the goodness found in every beast.
Now, welcome to this blessed bestiary, a zoo of words where animals run free. May ever you enjoy each antique fable placed nearby upon the family table.
Wow, Mr. Hudson, thank you. That was great.
Well, your writing is great. I'm sorry, I don't mean to overly flatter you, but and call me Deal. But this is really excellent poetry, and I think a great contribution to, you might say, the ongoing tradition of what, you know, sort of moral and spiritual learning through reflection on the animals, on God's creation of the animal.
It's an ongoing tradition, exactly as you say. It's we're all in this together, as Catholics, and we all have a part to play. And thank you so much for your part in promoting poetry. And particular this poetry, it doesn't pretend to be like Alexander Pope or anything, but it's an honest effort. It has defects in it. Every poem does, but it's an honest effort to focus on nature and to focus on the Bible and the poetry that's in the Bible. And to help everyone, families, people of all ages, to see God in nature through poetry, and so it's written in a way that is accessible, and thanks a lot for everything that you've done, Deal, with you know, the Catholic political efforts that you've done, that so many of us were part of that wave that you created, and we were hired and given a paycheck in Washington to and there were you know, because of that, when they looked at your resume and they asked those behind the scenes questions, you know, is this guy a Catholic, is he solid? Then yes, you know, a lot of good Catholics got hired, and it gave us really good experience. So now that I'm a little bit older, I'm trying to write poetry because it's just something that I believe in. So thank you very much for what you've done. It's been very important to a lot of people.
Well, I appreciate that, of course, and I hope at the end of the day that is all seen as a positive, that wave that you talk about, and sometime you can come back and we can talk about it in more depth from the perspective of someone who participated in it, but from another angle than myself. Sometimes you can't understand or appreciate the very thing you're in the middle of when it's happening.
Well, we have to keep trying. That's the main thing. God doesn't look at our successes necessarily. He looks at our effort. And we all have to keep trying and keep supporting each other as Catholics. Now, you know, no matter what we're doing, if you don't write poetry but you like books, then take a look at this book and support what we do in whatever way that we do it. And I know hundreds of Catholic dads who are making that commute into Washington, D.C. Every day, and we need to praise that and pray for that and just keep going And we have to do that. And, you know, our reward will be in heaven, if not politically. But we have to keep doing that. And we have to get fired up and keep doing that. Whether
remember there was a, you know, Scott, sorry to interrupt, but I'd say this before I forget it. But during that period that you were working as a Catholic in politics, and I was too, a very well-known Washington writer came out with a short story collection entitled The Congressman Who Read Balzac. And I remember seeing the title, and I went and got the book and read the short story. The reason I grabbed it so quickly was because I had not yet met an active politician who did read Balzac. And I can't tell you how many times I had the experience at a reception or a dinner where, you know, frankly, the subject of politics was getting boring, where I might try to move the conversation to books or music or something, only to have it completely fizzle out. And if you had been at the table, we would have had a ball. But it was very hard to, and I know they're there. I mean, I know they're there. I mean, if Eugene McCarthy had been around, he would have jumped all over it, right? But, and maybe if I had brought it up the few times I was with Henry Hyde, it might have worked. But you don't have much poetry in politics these days.
Yeah, especially now. You know, you don't have any, I mean, my goodness, I just, you know, it's...
I know, don't get me started kind of thing, right?
No, okay, so Reagan, you know, his famous metaphor, his parting metaphor, the city on the hill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was, you know, I think, you know, he's talking about his... He's using a metaphor right in one of his most important speeches ever. And if you go back and read Aristotle, Aristotle says that metaphor is so important for political speech. It really, you know, with the brevity and the clarity, shedding light on a subject. Well, America, a city on a hill is worth defending. America is a city on a hill. So let's carry these policies forward and keep the cause of America going, keep it alive. So that was Reagan's metaphor. And he was a great speechwriter.
And he had poetry because he was in the world of the arts for many, many years and was a master of language and knowing how language motivates people.
Yes, and he was a good man too, wasn't he? He was a good man, and he had good values, and he had a good sense of human nature. He had what I would say a good understanding of God. He wasn't Catholic, but
one of his parents was. I forget which one.
And so he had a good understanding of God, and look at what we have now. But don't get me started. But
no, we don't need to go.
Let's not give up.
We've been talking about Pope and the greatness of the tradition that Pope carried forward, and we've also mentioned this wonderful contribution you've made to that tradition in your bestiary. But you're working on another book. Tell us about that book. By the way, our listener. Remind you, I'm talking to Scott Weinberg, a Catholic writer and apologist. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a devotional to Our Lady. It's called Mary's Garden, and that's there's a tradition of a Mary's Garden, which is flowers and plants that are used in a devotional way to pay tribute to Our Lady. And this is in the tradition of the bestiary devotional because in addition to plants, we have, in addition to animals, we have plants that were used in the Middle Ages to signify or honor Our Lady.
And anybody who studied art history or even the history of gardening.
Yes.
We'll come across that.
You know, the marigold, the carnation is an abbreviation of the coronation.
Is this going to be a poetry book again?
Yeah, it's going to be in the quatrains as well. And it's just something I have to get done. And I think people are going to like it because it's going to be a – I finished the first draft, and it's intended to give people some joy in their prayer life and devotional. And it's consistent with what we believe. And I think it's just meant to be kind of a diversion from the sometimes prayer life can be kind of arduous, and this is meant to be a kind of a delightful addition to anybody's mm-hmm. prayer life. And so, and Our Lady is so important in poetry right now, because we have poetry is an imitation of nature, and Our Lady is, as the poets, our tainted nature's solitary boast. She was the only thing in nature that was made without defect. And, you know, we have these dogmas that are with us now, the Immaculate Conception and the Assumption. And I think her place in the world right now is we have, you know, not new revelation, but we have a time in history where attention can be drawn more towards Our Lady in these times. And I think that she is really a model for poetry, because poetry is an imitation of nature. And so when we try to use metaphors of nature to pay tribute to her attributes, such as her purity, or her devotion, I think that that's a good way to write poems. And so that's what I've done. And then when I get that done, I'm going to be writing a short novel, which will be kind of like an epic poem. But that's down the road. But it's,
you know,
the plants.
You know, Scott, the notion of Mary as a not notion, but the reality of Mary as nature in all its fullness and goodness prior to the fall is, like you say, it's so rich because there's a luminous overflow from her presence. It seems to me that I want to remind you of a quote from Hans-Urs von Balthasar that's found in the preface to his multi-volume work, Herrlichkeit, which we know in English translation as the glory of the Lord, that being that he's talking about beauty, and he says that anyone who purses their lips at beauty will soon neither be able to pray or even to love.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you're saying.
I think that is how we... look at, that is so rich.
That's why I've remembered it ever since I read it. That's why I brought it up.
Well,
you've got about a minute left.
I wrote the book because I was in a discussion with some students from a college, Thomas Aquinas College, and they were unable to discuss Our Lady in a tasteful way. The discussion soon collapsed into, you know, vulgarity. And I was like, my goodness, I am going to write a book about this, a poem in honor of Our Lady.
You may want to read a book that was dedicated to me, a translation by Erasmo Leiva of Threefold Garden, which is Hans-Urs von Balthasar's book on Mary.
And so a lot of people, I think, they separate beauty. They kind of compartmentalize beauty from the rational process.
Oh, everyone does. You know, as you know, I've got a book in progress on this myself. But I want you to come back and we'll talk about beauty per se, beauty as one of the transcendental properties of being, and why it has been, as it were, ignored for so long among Catholics and feared among Catholics. Just tell everybody once again how they can buy your wonderful bestiary.
You can get it at kellerbooks.com or at ecpubs.com, their online catalog.
Thank you. Scott Weinberg, thank you so much for being a guest on Church and Culture. I look forward to having you back soon. And to all of you who are listening, please join us again this time and this day next week for some more interesting conversations.
Any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In the 4th century, catechumens at the Easter Vigil would process through their First Communion chanting Psalm 23. It turns out Psalm 23 is actually a catechesis of the gateway sacraments of baptism, confirmation, and Eucharist. He leads me beside still waters. We emerge from the still waters of baptism as new creations. You prepare a table before me. Once we are baptized into the church, the Lord lays out the banquet of the Eucharist to nourish us. And you anoint my head with oil. In confirmation, our heads are anointed with oil, and we are forever sealed and identified with the cross of Jesus. And finally, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The gateway sacraments we have received encourage us all the days of our lives to follow the path of holiness towards our Father's house.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the story of Jonah and the Ninevites, like all stories in the Bible, are not just history lessons.
They are our stories today, our lived experience.
This is particularly true today.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Father Ben Lutke spoke about discipleship and our Mother Mary to the ladies of Heart to Heart Catholic Women's Apostolate last May.
When Jesus was hanging from the cross, he said to the disciple, not that disciple, to the disciple. The word in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin is a generic form of disciple. So in other words, he didn't say to John. I mean, Mel Gibson really did a beautiful job, and it was only one mistake. He interpreted as Jesus saying it to John.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. He's a former actor. His enthusiasm for our Lord and our Lady is contagious. His personal testimony is powerful. He humbly served for a time as Mother Teresa's driver. Put it all together and you have Father Ben Lutke. On our program this week, he speaks about Mary, Mediatrix of all graces. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this and every Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net.